streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your hosts, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is May 23rd, 2012. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the streets don't love you back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Mr. John Rowan. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He served in the New York City Police Department for 20 years prior to coming to the Valley. And during that time, he served in various positions of management and was a part of the team that developed the CompStat form of police management with Chief William Bratton. CompStat is the number one formula used in reducing crime and considered the premier form of police management, now used by the largest police departments in the United States. He has been a resident of the Valley for the last 6 years, and during that time, he was a member of command staff of a local police department and made Maricopa County his home. After 6 years of observing the actions of Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, he believes that it is time to bring a reform to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. After 29 years of continual law enforcement service to the community, John Rowan is announcing that he would use his experience to serve the people of Maricopa County as their sheriff if elected. Rowan will be running as a Democrat in this year's election. He is a man with a proven track record of integrity, leadership, and management experience in reforming other law enforcement agencies. John made his decision after being approached by several members of the community and with a deep personal commitment to serve this county to bring a higher standard of law enforcement to protect victims of crime and the community in which we all live. So tonight we're going to hear John's story, and before we do that, let me welcome Boyd to the show.
Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, and we appreciate Mr. John for coming on the show and spreading his word and his message. And we definitely hit the Streets Don't Love You Back movement is behind him 1,000%. So without further ado, we will ask Mr. John to formally introduce himself, and we will get the party started.
Well, good evening, Bob, Lucinda. Yeah. I appreciate you having me here.
We're happy to have you.
Excellent. So where would you like me to start?
Well, just let the people know a little bit. Let's go back to where you grew up at. You know, you're from New York. You grew up in the South Bronx. Tell us about the child, John the child, how you grew up, and some of the things that you went through living in South Bronx.
Absolutely. I grew up in the South Bronx, and at the age of 7, my father left us as a family. And I'm saying this not to win anybody's sympathy, but at that point in my life, I had to go out and really find a male role model, because I couldn't adopt one that I had in the household. My father was not a good example. And the three people that I came up with at the time was, there was a show on TV called Star Trek, and yeah. Captain James T. Kirk was the epitome of the most righteous person. I adopted him as a role model. I also used Winston Churchill from World War II. And the reason why I'm mentioning him as a role model is because he wasn't always just a good person, but he was a fantastic leader and very much a hands-on leader. And that's the type of leader who I've aspired to be over the years. The rest of my childhood, one of the reasons why I joined the NYPD at the young age of 20 was to escape poverty, for one. It was a good middle-class job that offered great benefits. And I entered the police department, and I really took to it. I did well. I was a little bit lucky. Right after I got out of the academy, I was lucky enough to make a big bank robbery arrest and get noticed. And then I kind of moved forward and kept working. And there was another time where I got bribed by a drug dealer shortly thereafter for the amount of $63,000, and I arrested that individual. And as a result of that, I got moved into like an investigative unit, and my career started to take off from there.
Wow. Now, go back a little bit and talk about growing up. You were in a household of domestic violence, and that's a big issue in today's society. So can you talk a little bit about what you went through and maybe some of the things that you feel that you can change now at this point in your life?
Oh, absolutely. Once again, you know, actually living it, you have a whole different insight and a sensitivity, you know, to the victims of domestic violence. One of the things that was done correctly, and it wasn't done when I was a child, is they mandated many police departments, if the police show up on a domestic violence call and there's an injury, usually domestic violence is male on female. If she has an injury, and even if she states she doesn't want him arrested, we now mandate that police officers arrest that individual so that they have to go in front of the judge and get it all straightened out, or, you know, the judge can order that individual to leave the household. Back in the 70s, that did not exist. You know, the police would show up and they would think that a man's house is his castle and they would allow this to go on. So I definitely have a sensitivity. And one of the things I want to do as your sheriff is I want to have specific officers assigned as domestic violence deputies to cover certain areas within MCSO so that they go out, you know, 3 days later and they check on the household to make sure that after this person has been released from, you know, detention, that there isn't any further violence in the household.
Definitely.
Yeah, and one thing I want to ask you too, Mr. John, since we're on that subject, As becoming our sheriff here in Maricopa County, further with the domestic violence, you know, me and my wife is also an advocate for domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book out entitled Never Hit a Woman. That book came out last year that I wrote, and I just wanted to ask you, as far as the domestic violence that we see up today, with these guys out here nowadays that, you know, they beat a woman half to death and then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. you know, they go to this domestic violence class, they're back on the street, versus the drug dealer who sells drugs and he get a mandatory life sentence. How do you feel about that, not just only as a police officer, but as a person?
Well, there's two parts to that question. One is about, like, the turnstile form of justice where someone is arrested for domestic violence and then they spend a few hours down at the county lockup and then they come right back to the same residence. And often, you know, the police are called back out the next day for the same issue. That's something that we definitely have to take a look at, and we have to prevent that from ever happening. We have to safeguard, you know, once again, the victim is usually a female. We have to put more steps in place to safeguard that household. The other part of that question was about mandatory drug sentencing. And were you comparing that to domestic violence, or were you saying that we look so much heavier at drugs than domestic violence?
Yeah, that's exactly was my statement. I think that not only the government, but law enforcement, they look at drug dealing, you know, as a bad thing, which it is a bad thing. Should nobody
right.
have to sell drugs? But at the same time, I feel that a woman shouldn't have to get beat half to death, and then all of a sudden a guy get 18 months versus a guy who sold drugs. And to me, as an ex-drug dealer, drugs is a choice mm-hmm. for somebody to come by and use, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a
right.
choice for a woman to get beat half to death and you get 18 months or you just get a slap on the wrist and go to a domestic violence class. I think that domestic violence in this country should be looked at more closer, and I think that a man who does that to our women out here, this should be mandatory sentence for them as well as the drug dealer.
Well, a violent assault against a woman is referred to as a crime against persons, and crimes against persons should be taken very serious. and I would work diligently and in partnership with whoever the county attorney happens to be to make sure that we give much stiffer sentences to criminals who commit assault, including domestic violence. And one of the things I plan on doing as your sheriff is to go through all the prisoners that are being held by county, particularly in Tent City, and to find out, do they need to be incarcerated, or are there other options for them? Meaning, yeah, violent people we want removed from our society so that they can't harm anyone again. If someone's been arrested first time for a relatively minor offense on a drug charge, would it better serve the society if they were being held in some other program? You know, ankle bracelet, home detention, things of that nature.
Yeah, and I respect you for saying that too, Mr. John. And also, I think by people who sell drugs, a lot of people who sell drugs is not out here for the flashy things, is not out here for a car or a pair of Michael Jordans, you know. A lot of people who sell drugs is trying to eat and pay bills and different things like that, which, once again, drug selling is wrong. But a lot of these mandatory 20-year life sentences like that, I mean, how can you give an individual a chance and they're 17, 18 years old and you give them a mandatory life sentence and they have never did nothing in their life, you know, and I have seen this over the years. A prime example, a friend of mine got caught for selling drugs back in the day. And at that time in Detroit, Michigan, they had that mandatory 650 law, you know. Anything over 650 grams is mandatory life. And
it's also referred to as the Rockefeller law, yes.
Right, that blew me away. You know, I'm like, wow, you know what I'm saying? So he ended up getting out last year. He did 18 years on that case, had never been in trouble a day in his life, never even had a traffic ticket. He did 18 years, and they changed that law up in Michigan, and he got out last year, did 18 years on that case, you know? And like he was telling me, he said, man, I done seen guys up there like a revolving door come up in there for beating their wives, their girlfriends, half to death, and, you know, like a revolving door. And I'm with you, John, when you said these criminals that beat our women and do assaults and hurt our children, that's what a mandatory sentence should be at. And the guy who out here trying to make some money, he should be in a program where you can educate him and teach him that you don't have to sell drugs. We got a program over here for you to get educated and something to do in your life where you can sit back and tell the next individual, well, this is what I did, and I didn't have to sell drugs no more. You know, I got a voluntary program to go to do something positive, you know? And we have to give people a chance.
Now, what did they give your friend? What kind of program did he enter when he was released? How did he acclimate back into our society? Because that's really an important part of the justice system, and it gets neglected most of the time.
Yeah, and it was a great thing with him because he was already mentally prepared to come home, and right now he is the manager down at the Salvation Army in downtown Michigan, and he got that job 3 weeks after he came home. Because they hire ex-felons, and he's a manager down there. And I'm so proud of him, you know what I'm saying? Because he came home with a goal. He came home with a passion to do something right. He went to school in there. He wasn't one of them cats that went to the joint, and when they put the life sentence on him, you know, he wanted to be thugged out, go back and forth in the hole, you know. His whole mentality was great compared to other guys that I knew coming up that came out like a revolving door, and they go right back after they spend so many years, then they are institutionalized because that's that's what respect that is in there. You know, out here is a whole different flavor because they haven't been out here.
Well, that's a success story, and I'm glad to hear that. But one of the things that we do poorly in many parts of the country, and in particular in Maricopa County, is we offer no program when you get released. If you spend 18 months in Tent City, the day you're released, you're just dropped off, often in downtown Phoenix. You're given a very small amount of money, and you're told where to report in about 2 weeks' time to check in. And then if you have nothing to do, you're going to fall back on what you know, and a lot of these people, what they know is criminality. So they're going to go back to what they were doing before and end up right back in county jail.
Amen. And that's why we need you, Mr. John, out here as our sheriff, as a man with compassion, not just for people in general, but for people of all creeds of life. You know what I'm saying? And
oh,
you're
absolutely
willing to give a man or woman a chance that want a chance in life, you know? And that's what I respect about you, man. You know, that right there, you got my whole full respect by even saying that, you know?
Thank you. And we have to offer the people solutions. We know that just locking up some kid every 18 months has not been working for the last 30 years. So what makes us think it's going to work for the next 30 years? We have to start to offer solutions when people come out of incarceration, programs for them to acclimate back into our societies and be productive.
Amen. And, you know, that's what we're pushing out here, and we will definitely keep pushing that for you all the way up to, you know, time to vote day, you know. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate you. You know, I read up on you, and, you know, I was impressed by your resume, you know. And it's just that, you know, everybody is not a criminal because they go out and hustle, you know.
Sure.
A criminal is a guy, he wake up every day to hurt someone. That's a criminal to me, you
mm-hmm.
know. But if you wake up, you know, out here hustling, you know, whether it's, you know, selling shoes or selling water on the street, and you're selling drugs, once again, drugs is wrong to sell. But like you said, if a person only know that, once they get dropped back down in society after 18 months or 5 years without no education and no programs to go to, they fall right back to the hustle game and then end right back in the joint. So it's a revolving door that we must
right.
put a stop on that.
Amen. Agreed.
John, we have a question in the chat room, and they're asking, what type of program would you create to solve this problem?
Well, first of all, the first thing I want to work in partnership is with some private companies that are out there that excel at, one, drug rehab. I mean, I think you might be aware of this. If you call around and say, I don't have a lot of money, but I am looking to enter a drug rehab program, you are going to have great difficulty on average. You know, one, if you find one, usually there's a tremendous waiting list. And two, they're difficult to find. That's one of the first things I want to work with, is to lower the drug addiction that has paralyzed our society. We talked before about drug dealers going to jail. If we treat the victims of drug dealers and, you know, the addicts and remove them, you know, take that disease away and make them healthy, then the customers are eliminated from the drug dealers. So that's one thing that I would work greatly in partnership with some private companies, and also look for some other state and federal programs to make sure that people that want to get off drugs have an avenue to get off drugs. The other thing is, when someone comes out of incarceration, they have to be prepared. For the last 18 months, 2 years, and sometimes longer, they've now been out of our society. We have to give them real skills while they're inside being incarcerated. Give them real technical job skills so that they have something to do when they come out.
Definitely. We need more reentry programs.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to think of ways, I guess, to keep people from being incarcerated so that we don't have to have so many reentry programs for people coming out of jail. And I know that we're never going to solve all the issues. We're not ever going to get rid of the drugs and the gangs and the different things that go on out here.
Right.
But like Rob and I always say, you know, education is the key, and we need to get into the schools with the children, you know, kindergarten on. There needs to be a program in the
mm-hmm.
school educating them, you know, about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, these types of issues that, you know, these children, as young as they are going through problems in their homes every day, in the communities every day. And if
mm-hmm.
they don't know how to be able to cope with these problems, you know, they're just going to, you know, I don't know, become failures or just be in the middle of a bunch of chaos. And so we definitely push education, but at the same time, we know that you know, we can't get rid of all the victims, and we can't get rid of all the drug users or drug sellers, drug dealers,
mm-hmm.
Good things and different things. For a lot of people that are in that life, not all, but a lot have been in that life growing up. You know, mom and dad were drug dealers or gangbangers and belonged mm-hmm. to, you know, a gang, and grandma and grandpa were members of the gang, and, you know, they just feel like they can't get out of it and that there's no other way. And some of them, that is truly the only thing they know. Now, I can't say that for everybody,
right.
and I'm not making excuses for anybody, but definitely, you know, some of them, you know, they don't know any better. So how can we, as a society or as leaders of our communities, be able to create those educational programs to educate the kids?
Absolutely. And it goes back a little bit to what Rob said before about drug dealers going in on relatively minor offenses and getting lifelong sentences. We have to make a review to make sure that the people that are being incarcerated are the right people to be in there, you know, the violent people, the ones that are really damaging our society, as opposed to those that are just in the wrong place at the wrong time or perhaps made a bad decision and ended up in a relatively minor offense and yet got a long sentence. So we have to make sure that the right, that we audit everyone that's been incarcerated and make sure that the right people are in, and that people that are much more apt to be rehabilitated, that we release them and put them in programs and get them back out and acclimate them as quickly as possible back to the streets. Most elected officials are beginning to realize that we cannot arrest our way out of every problem on the street. You can't put every criminal in jail for long periods of time. No nation can. And even if you could, is that the answer you really want to offer people? Is that what you want to offer an entire generation? You know, if you do something wrong, we'll put you in jail forever. No. So what we have to do is to work in partnership with the community, with religious groups, with schools, and educate everyone from a very early age on about the consequences of decisions that they make.
Right. Definitely. And we know that putting it people in prison only educates them more about how to go out in the streets and be bad. Because
yeah,
they're learning
most of the time.
Exactly. I have a comment from the chat room from the same person that asked that question, and they say, "How about creating a program that takes inmates and uses them for local construction projects that will reduce their sentence and give them a skill as well? And it would, you know, like you know, repairing the roads and different things like that."
Right. That's an absolutely wonderful suggestion. It just has to be managed properly. And there also has to be safeguards in place, once again, so that we the people are being protected, so that someone just doesn't get outside the fence and just run away. But that's an absolutely wonderful suggestion, and it's worked in other places throughout the United States.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, John, we know that there's a lot of corruption. There's good and bad in everything, but we know that we know there's corruption in the police force and politics and different things. And you've had some problems firsthand with that. I want to, if you could tell us a little bit about, there's a story that you have told about 18-year-old Gerald Pendleton. And could you tell us that story and a little bit about what happened with that and why you feel the way you do?
Absolutely. It was a Sunday. It was April 6th of 2008. I was the assistant to the chief of police for the city of Goodyear. My phone rang early that morning, and I was notified that there had been a murder, which is a fairly rare event in that small city. I responded into work that morning, and I was informed that a young man was struck by an auto and left for dead on this road. Immediately or shortly thereafter, I started to notice anomalies taking place, that this case was not being handled, in my opinion, properly. I started to notify other people within the chain of command in the police department there. What happened was at no time were detectives ever called out that morning, which is very, very odd. There were just a bunch of other anomalies that took place. And then the following day, a conversation took place in my presence that stated that one of the officers had felt that or had stated that he struck this kid and may have killed this kid. I then eventually ended up testifying under federal oath to what I knew that took place in the first person, And now, 3 years later, they authorized an investigation by a private attorney who uncovered that the officer in question stated to the officer who was investigating the accident that he had struck that individual. That officer did not document that statement for a period of 3 years.
Wow.
So I strongly believe, using a reasonable person standard, that the officer in question did strike and kill Jared Pendleton, and that several other officers covered that fact up.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, and that happens, I mean, quite a bit, I would say. I don't know why some of the police officers think they're above the law, but, you know, they are here to serve and protect, and if they all did what they were supposed to do, we would have a safer community. But in some situations, it's really sad that, you know, they are human, but it's still sad to say that they don't, you know, speak up and tell the truth in some situations.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, no one is above the law. And one thing that you still have a lot of in Maricopa County is kind of like the good old boy form of government still exists in places here. And they think as long as you're someone that's nice and they like you, then anything they do, they can justify. And that's not the way government's supposed to run. That's not the oath that a police officer takes. They take an oath to uphold the law. And it's just out and out wrong. It should not take place. And once again, as your sheriff, I can guarantee within 24 hours, a large-scale investigation of the Jared Pendleton murder will be conducted by MCSO.
That sounds like a winner right there. And I want to go back to, Mr. John, on when you said that a drug dealer tried to bribe you for $63,000, and you arrested him on that, you know? And I just want to say that, you know, that's very rare that that happened, because back in the 80s and in the 70s in Michigan, police was taking bribes like it was no tomorrow, you know? And that right there, what, you know, I had to really listen to, you know? So you let the drug dealer know, I don't care how much money you got, what you're doing is wrong, and we got to straighten this out, you know? And it was so many cats. It was so many police in Detroit taking payoffs back in the days when we was all selling drugs and things. You know, I mean, it was just unbelievable. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And how a lot of them got strung out on drugs at the same time when the crack era first hit in the early 80s. You know, and it was just amazing to me how they would just, you know, belittle themselves. And like you said, you know, you take an oath to uphold the law. But now you become a dope fiend, and now you're working for the dope boy. You know what I'm saying? So it's just you really have to watch individuals, whether they police or regular citizens, because once you get on them drugs, you're a whole different animal, you know?
Right. And once you allow corruption to take place within a law enforcement agency, you then lose all control and all discipline. How can a supervisor discipline a police officer when that police officer knows that the boss takes bribes too?
Right, right.
So it becomes like a band of pirates.
Right. Every Friday you get your $10,000. So, yeah, you know, you can't tell me nothing when I see you taking your paper going home every week. That's $40,000 a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a complete breakdown of the whole organization, and it cannot be tolerated.
Right, and that's what we like about you. You know, I mean, I'm listening to you, I'm vibing with you, and like, you know, a guy like me coming from the streets, you know, I done seen a lot of all of that, you know, and it just amazes me, and you know, that I get a chance to really sit with a young man that's really upholding the law and that's really out here trying to make a difference, you know, not only for the community but around the country. You know, and you have done did that in so many ways that you have made a difference in so many areas throughout the country. And now we're just waiting for you to step in play so you can make a big difference here in Arizona.
Thank you. I truly appreciate that. And I truly do want to make a difference for the citizens and the people of Maricopa County.
Yeah, we definitely, like I said, we definitely behind you 1,000%. We promote you all the time on our movement page and on Facebook and everywhere. And we just need you to get in place. So, like I said, our prayers are definitely going up that the Father slides you in the home base and slide homeboy out of that seat. You feel me?
Yeah, I think it's time for the current sheriff to retire. Most definitely.
Time for a change. And we definitely know that you're big on reform and have a lot of changes in store. Tell us a little bit about the CompStat program and what strategies that you developed and how that works.
Absolutely. What CompStat does is it monitors crime as it happens. And then it monitors the police department's response as it's happening. And what it does is it then overlays both of those, and it holds police management accountable. So what that means is they pin map all the crime that takes place in any town, neighborhood, or city in Maricopa County, and then they look at, you know, how many detectives did you assign to this, how many police officers were working that night, how long did it take them to respond to this crime? And if the numbers are bad, they're going to hold that commander responsible. And if that commander can't get a grip on what's going on, that commander is going to have to step aside or be demoted or be transferred. And that's the quick version of how CompStat works, and it has been very effective in just about every city where it's been placed.
And did you place that in the West Valley when you were there?
Yes, I did. I was brought in to the city of Goodyear. I was one of the mandates that I was hired by was to get CompStat up and running. And in New York City, it lowered the murder rate by 70% in 3 years. Well, in a city like Goodyear, if they have two murders a year, you know, that's about on average. It did lower the response time of police officers within 30 days. It used to take 7 minutes for a police officer to make it to an emergency scene, and within 30 days it was cut down to 3 minutes and 28 seconds. So even in small areas, even in bedroom communities, CompStat makes a difference.
Definitely. Tell us a little bit about how you were picked by Rudy Giuliani in New York.
A little bit of lucky, a little bit of being competent, and a little bit of being in the right place at the right time. In 1994, I was appointed as the chief of staff for the deputy police commissioner. At the same exact time, a new mayor took over, and this mayor got elected on the platform of lowering crime. And until that day, they always measured the police department by how many arrests that a police department makes. And the only thing is, if it doesn't have the effect of lowering crime, then it's not being affected. So they turned around and said, we don't care how many people you arrest, we want to see crime going down. So that means you better arrest the right people, start incarcerating the right people, and solving these crimes. So we then turned around and we were told, by the way, if we're not successful in 90 days, the entire team was going to be transferred out and a new team brought in. And a police commissioner by the name of William J. Bratton came from Boston and had a whole new program. And we worked as a team, and we entered into something called the zero tolerance, the broken window theory, and the CompStat form of police management. And we were able to lower crime. And that crime was completely out of control at that point in time in New York City. And within the first year, they lowered the robbery rate by half. And in 3 years, they were able to lower the murder rate by 70%.
Wow. Yeah, I just want the viewers to know a little bit, too, as well as you became a police officer, was it in 1983?
Correct.
And it says that that you had been stabbed in the line of duty, and that you also received 11 citations of heroism from the NYPD. During those 20 years, you served as an officer, a detective in the Elite Organized Crime Control Bureau, and then the Intelligence Division, and you were also trained in the U.S. Secret Service. He performed dignitary protection, which included guarding the U.S. president, who also visited New York City. You served as chief of staff for the deputy police commissioner and then deputy chief of investigations for the state of New York. So tell us a little bit about those days.
Those days were fun and interesting. I enjoyed my career very much. I enjoyed serving the people very much. I had the honor of doing dignitary protection for three separate presidents, which was an honor. The other thing is, in New York City, there is the United Nations there, and diplomats that are visiting also need large amounts of security, so I'd be assigned when foreign diplomats would be visiting the city. That was very interesting. Doing, you know, in-depth investigations, whether they were narcotic investigations or homicide investigations, that was also very special. You truly feel for the victims of a murder. As a detective, you have to learn everything about them and deal with the victim's family. And one of the things that I do propose that, you know, God forbid if someone in the family is a victim of a homicide here in Maricopa County, they will get to meet with myself and the detectives that are handling the case within a reasonable amount of time, perhaps 30 days, and they'll receive an update on what's going on and what the detectives are doing to solve this case. And I'll make sure that the detectives are giving their all and that they care deeply about this person that's been murdered and their family. And in cases against people that are lesser, like armed robberies, I'm going to do the same thing, but they're going to be meeting with one of my chiefs because, obviously, as the sheriff, I cannot be everywhere all the time. Getting back to New York in 1994, being at the right place at the right time, it was quite an honor to be picked to help reform that police department. The last time the NYPD was reformed was in 1898, and that was by Theodore Roosevelt, who then went on to become president of the United States. So it was a really daunting task. And then, unfortunately, on September 11th, I lived about a block from the World Trade Center, and I started that day off as a rescuer. And at one point, I was in the South Lobby. But when it came down, my apartment was badly damaged, and I ended up being a refugee by the end of the day. So I spent a great deal of time down there, and I was appointed to take over special projects for Ground Zero. And I had to deal with 26 different federal agencies in 46 different countries and tens of thousands of volunteers who came just to help us. And I can think of no greater challenge of leadership than having that thrust upon me at that time. And it was, you know, completely unexpected as it was. And, you know, over the next 6 months or so, you know, we got through it. And I think overall, myself and my team did an outstanding job.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about the events of that day and kind of just how you felt and what happened as you went through that day.
Sure. First, I have to start off with a human interest story, which kind of puts everything into perspective. When I woke up on the morning of September 11th, it was election day in New York City, and a friend of mine was running for mayor, and it was someone who I had helped in the past. And if he became mayor, I was going to be elevated within city government, within the police department, and I knew he wasn't going to win. So I felt very sad for myself. That, you know, that I wasn't getting promoted. And I got up and I had the day off and I went out to help him go to different polls and things of that nature. And then as the terrorist attack unfolded, I immediately responded to the area, to the World Trade Center. And then when the towers came down and I was still alive, and unfortunately 17 friends of mine did not survive that day, I realized, you know, after getting through the sorrow of missing them, of what really matters in our lives. Instead of worrying about things like getting promoted, I was just so happy to still be alive. I remember talking to my daughter on the phone that morning, and she was shocked that I had survived because she knew, you know, living so close that I would be right there. And it just puts everything in perspective as part like God's plan. What really matters is our relationships and who we care about.
Definitely. You know, and that goes in anything that we do. You know, and sometimes we forget, I guess, what really matters in life because we're so busy working and trying to advance and get ahead and be successful. You know, we need to take a few minutes back and remember family and friends and what life really should be, I guess.
Right. Right, absolutely. And I injured my right foot that day, and then a few days later, the pain went away, so I didn't address it for like 6 months. I had to have two surgeries, and to this day, I still wear two socks every day because it's the only way that pads the pain on my right foot. So by the end of every day, my right foot starts to hurt, and I still think back. I don't complain about that pain at all.
Right.
Because I know so many other people who had to give so much more than that.
Well, we know that was a very sad day in our world. And, you know, did you actually go in and I know that at one point in your life you were an EMT, so did you actually go in and kind of help with the rescue on a physical level?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I had other concerns because of my background, because I was in the intelligence division prior to that. I was concerned that there might be terrorists on the ground and in the area. It's not uncommon on a terrorist attack like the train attack in Madrid, Spain, to have secondary explosives on the ground. And so I was very much concerned about other problems that could have happened, and I was giving first aid. And I know I used my tie as a tourniquet, but to this day, I don't remember what I did with my suit jacket. I know I gave it to someone. I just don't remember exactly who. So I gave whatever first aid I could, and we helped evacuate. And the one thing is that there is a lot of resources in New York City. There were hundreds of ambulances there. So before the South Tower came down, most of the people that could be evacuated were, and I was assisting with that effort.
Wow. I can't even imagine what it was like to be there. And we still have all the people that we lost in our thoughts and prayers, and for so many family members that lost people, you know, in 911, you know, we still give out our deepest sympathies, and, you know, it was just a horrible day
right.
for everyone.
And may we never forget and always stay vigilant.
Exactly.
Mm.
Well, let's move on to another question here in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that the SB 1070 bill has created quite the stir out here. What do you feel about that, and what do you plan on doing, if anything, to change that? Or
okay. I was never in favor of 1070. And the first thing that I didn't like about the bill was it made no exemption for the victims of crime. So you could have your car stolen, you could be the victim of a sexual abuse, go in and report it to the police, and they can ask you, you know, what's your point of entry? So you would be victimized a second time. As a result of that, you have now created this big pool of people who can be the victims of crime, and criminals know they're not going to report it. So I am not in favor of 1070 at all. The way that it has been enforced in Maricopa County is the worst in the state of Arizona. We have multitudes of lawsuits, somewhere between $150 million and $300 million being charged against MCSO for having illegal undocumented immigrant sweeps where they pull people over simply because they have tan skin. You
right.
cannot do that under the Constitution of the United States. You cannot do that under the Bill of Rights. And when you do, you're violating federal law. And it's unconscionable. No matter what the Supreme Court rules come next month, two federal judges have already ruled that the way Sheriff Arpaio has chosen to enforce 1070 is illegal and immoral.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You know, in Arizona, I mean, there's so many Hispanics, and, you know, not, I mean, there's just so many people from all over the world, you know, and I, it just breaks my heart to think that our own people that have lived here their whole lives, you know, are being treated like this, like an outcast,
right.
It seems like.
Absolutely, you know, and it breaks up families. And, you know, Arpaio has this way of managing through bait and switch where he never talks about his crime stats. He very rarely ever talks about solving a big crime. But what he does talk about is rounding up day laborers and then having a big press conference and talking about what a success it has been to the community when it has done nothing to lower crime.
Right.
Exactly. The only thing it done got is people disliking him for always racial profiling him, you know. And, you know, it's people like my missus said that's been born over here in America, you know, and been here 20, 30 years. So why all of a sudden now you're looking at things a little bit different, you know? You have to stay focused on what's really happening. If you're about protecting the border, okay, protect the border. If you're about just pulling people over for no reason, you know, then you're totally out of order, you know? And a lot of people don't say nothing about that because, like you just said, Mr. John, he rounds up Labor Day workers, you know, and all of that. Then he had, like, you know, did a success story and caught $10 million, you know?
Right. And that begs the question, is he doing that just to pander to his political base? Because it's really not doing anything to fight crime at all.
At all, you know? And once again, we letting the fans know and the viewers know right here on the Streets and Love You Back radio show, if you live in anywhere in Arizona, period, you know, Maricopa County, Phoenix, wherever you at, we asking you to go out and vote for my man, Mr. John. He's the right candidate. He's the right man for the job. And we got to slide him into that seat. We got to slide that other homie up out of there. You feel me? So we asking everybody to go out and put your boots on and your bootstraps up, and let's get this going out here and start promoting Mr. John, because he stands for realness out here, and he stands for not just for himself, but he stands for all mankind, and that's what time it is.
Thank you, Rob. I truly appreciate that. And I think it's time for change. I think it's time to retire this individual, and I think it's time to really kind of bring a whole new progressive reform to MCSO.
Oh, without a doubt. And we're going to be behind you. We're going to be pushing it on the radio show, the TV show, all over, because we're going to get these people riled up because they've been ready for a change, but it just wasn't nobody for that seat. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So now we got to get the people fired up and get the people understanding that it's somebody for that seat, and that seat need to come unhot because it's lukewarm right now, and we need that seat hot all day, every day, for my man, Mr. John, to sit in there and get his game going.
Absolutely.
You know, the sad thing is, I think, too, that that a lot of the, well, obviously the illegal people in Arizona can't vote. But is there a program that you would do to maybe allow the people to become citizens, to become, you know, taxpayers like the rest of us?
Well, in order for that, we'd have to work in partnership with the federal government. But I definitely think that there should be some pathway and make it somewhat easier. Military service should be one. College graduates here who have not had any problems with the law should certainly be considered for moving up to green card status, citizenship status. And I would gladly work with the federal government in partnership to make that happen.
Definitely. That would be an awesome program for so many people here in Arizona.
Right.
What is your feelings on the border and securing the border, especially in Arizona at this time?
Well, contrary to popular belief held by the current sheriff, this county does not border Mexico. So, you know, that is primarily handled by the Border Patrol. And, you know, our borders are a lot more secure than people make it sound. You know, it is not just a complete open, you know, it's not an easy walk into this nation like some people would like you to believe. It is far more difficult, and there's a far greater chance of being apprehended by the Border Patrol for those who try to illegally immigrate across it. It's not as easy as people want you to believe.
Right. And we know that even though there's a fence on the border, the drug dealers and the cartels have other ways of getting into the United States. So it's not just because there's Border Patrol and a fence doesn't mean that it's necessarily secure anyways. It's not. I don't feel that it's any more secure than it was before.
Right. And that's something I would also, you know, work in partnership with the sheriffs down on the border, you know, in cooperation, you know, to help them with issues, but mostly, you know, I want to keep it so that we in Maricopa only worry about the problems here and not place ourselves on the border.
Definitely.
You know, and another thing I'd like to do, and you see in my literature, is I want to return the power of the office of sheriff to the people. I plan on doing that within 30 days of my appointment by having a citizen complaint review board, where members of the community will meet with me approximately every 2 months, and we will go over all complaints of misconduct against any deputies in MCSO, and they will make recommendations on what they think the discipline should be.
Right, definitely.
You know, so, yeah, because it's time for the sheriff to work with the community and remind them that we work for the people. It's not the other way around.
Right. It is a service.
Right. Right. And the community's input is absolutely vital.
Definitely. John, we have about 5 more minutes. Can you give us just some highlights of you know, your platform and, you know, any last words that you have? Let us know what you're looking towards, what your goals are over the next few years. And
sure.
In the next year. And just give us a few last words.
Thank you, Lucinda. First of all, one of the things I'm going to do is, as your sheriff, I'm going to promise that a case will never go uninvestigated by a detective. There are hundreds and hundreds of cases currently, right now at MCSO, that have not been investigated. Sometimes, even when the defendant was named, they still did not go out and do their job. That will never happen to another victim once I become sheriff. I'm going to reorganize, refocus, and reform all the detective units in MCSO. Further, I have a slogan that goes, I'm going to keep the good guys good. And that means, as your sheriff, I am the highest law enforcement authority in the county of Maricopa. I will investigate misconduct conducted by any other department within Maricopa County. So if you hear of a police officer in another city or town that's doing something wrong, I will be on that. I will make sure that the good guys in Maricopa County stay good, and I'm going to put the good old boy form of government to bed.
That's right.
Yeah, because there's still way too much of that going on out here. And what I'm going to do is use my skill set that I brought from outside and my ability to reform dysfunctional or broken police departments to MCSO. And right now, I'm asking for your listeners' help because there are some things that I still need. I am turning in my signatures next week. I could still use people who are registered Democrats or registered independents to sign my petitions. I still need volunteers to spread the word. And like everybody else, I could use some money because this is a grassroots campaign. So if anyone is listening out there who would like to help, if they can go to www.rowan, which is my last name, R-O-W-A-N, reform, which is R-E-F-O-R-M, 2012.com. They can see my whole platform. They could send an email. There's a phone number there. I return all calls, all emails. Your listeners and their concerns are very important to me, and I want to be their sheriff. And the last promise I make to them is I am not a politician. I am not going to lie to them, and I'm not going to promise them something I can't deliver.
All right. Well, we're here to support you in any way we can. John, let us know if there's anything we can do for you as far as getting the message out there, and we'll definitely do our part for you. And we appreciate you coming on tonight and sharing your life with us and some of the things that you've been through. And you know, we are looking forward to seeing you as Sheriff of Maricopa County. We definitely need some changes made in our communities and within our police force system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we believe that you're the man for that job.
Well, thank you, Lucinda. Thank you, Rob. God bless. And I, too, appreciate it so much.
Oh, without a doubt. We appreciate you. And we want you to give them that website one more time, Mr. John, and let them know. Go ahead and put something in that account for Mr. John and log on and support him. Get them signatures out there. Hey, you know what they say now. Get up, because a man that sleep don't not come to a sleeper but a dream. So stop sleeping and get up and support my man, Mr. John.
Thank you so much, Rob. This is John Rowan, and I can be reached at www.rowan, which is R-O-W-A-N, reform, R-E-F-O-R-M, 2012.com. I return all phone calls and all emails.
All right. That's what it is, ladies and gentlemen. So, hey, you know what it is. Get up tomorrow and start handling your business. And tonight you can log on the website. You don't have to get out the house for that. You can jump online right now while we're talking on the phone and get busy. So we appreciate you coming on the line tonight, Mr. John, and spreading that message. And we will continue spreading that message for you. And any other last words you would like to let the viewers know?
No, just I appreciate their opinion. God bless, and so nice talking with you all.
Thank you so much, John. Have a great night, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Wonderful. Let's make a change.
That's right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, we're going to go out tonight with a commercial by My Video Talk. Have a great week, and join us back here next Wednesday night.
Everyone agrees that video is the next massive phenomenon on the internet, changing the way people communicate. I mean, why type when you can talk? Why read when you can watch? And whether you're an author, business owner, pastor, artist, or just the captain of your softball team, you are promoting something. And the best way to promote on the internet, it's not boring emails and static web pages, it's video. Think about it. What if you could harness the global reach of the internet with the power of video? What if you could do it simply, easily, and inexpensively? How would that change your business, your sales, your life? You can today with My Video Talk Studio. Imagine sending custom branded video emails to your customers, fully branded, customizable, and personalized with your colors, logos, banners, images, promoting you, not a competitor. All with a few clicks of the mouse. No programming, no web designer. My Video Talk video email technology combines the power of television advertising with the ease of email. But that's just the beginning. You also get My Video Channel, your own private website. Fully and easily customizable, easy to set up, no need for a web designer. No need to use free public services anymore. No competition or third-party advertisements popping up. And so simple, anyone can use it right out of the box. And My Video Broadcaster, HD quality, live video that you can use to demo a product, train employees, or host your own infomercial globally. And it's simple to use. It's like having your own TV studio. Plus, My Live Learning with access to the world's best training and education online on demand. And My Video Web Meeting and My Video Web Show. Live multi-party video conferencing that used to cost thousands of dollars. And your own live or pre-recorded branded 24/7 station that lets you broadcast to the world. Never before have so many features been offered in one turnkey system. A system that works on Macs and PCs, a system that is easy to use right out of the box, even for a total computer beginner. My Video Talks, taking you and your brand global. Welcome to the future of communication.